was a kid, the adults in my life called me careless and lazy on a regular basis. I realize that sounds a little harsh by today's standards, but honestly, I can't say they were entirely wrong. My room was pretty much always a mess, and I raced through school assignments without bothering to read the directions. I would tell you I had poor study habits, except that would imply I had study habits at all. As an adult, my house is quite tidy. I study for hours every single day getting ready for this show, and I care a great deal about getting things right. I've become a lot more conscientious, which is to say, my personality has changed a lot over time, and I'm guessing yours has as well. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Of course, we evolve as we mature, but that process doesn't end once the prefrontal cortex finishes developing in our mid-20s. Most of us gradually shake off some angst and grow more friendly as we get older. We also tend to be less open to new experiences and more risk-averse. And if our personalities can change without us even trying, it should also be possible to amend them through conscious effort, right? Christian Jarrett is here to talk to us about that. He's a cognitive neuroscientist and deputy editor of the journal Psyche. His book is called Be Who You Want, Unlocking the Science of Personality Change. Christian, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we get started, we want to welcome in new listeners joining us today from KUNR in Reno, Nevada. We are very happy to have you with us. All right, Christian, there are these five main personality traits we all display along some sort of spectrum. We'll talk about them individually in a minute, but what do we know about the biological factors that might play into our personalities?
Well, there's the genetic influences that we inherit from our parents. And then personality gets under the skin in other ways as well. So studies have shown that differences between introverts and extroverts, for example, can be seen at the level of the insulation of neurons in the brain, for example, and differences in microgut bacteria, and even things like across the different personality traits, even differences in things like signs of inflammation in the body. So you get all these different levels of the underlying biology of personality.
And of course, our personalities are shaped by experience and life circumstance. I describe myself as tidy in the introduction, but that only really happened since I married my husband, who came into our relationship as a tidy person. So how subject to change is personality?
Well, so for a long time in psychology, there was this tug of war, this battle between those experts who said situations explain our behavior and those who said it is to do with our personality traits. And so for that reason, the personality theorists, they almost overplayed their argument, and they said that personality was relatively, you know, pretty much fixed. And in fact, you can trace that all the way back to the great American psychologist, William James. He said our personalities are set like plaster by age 30, beyond which we can't change anymore. But I'd say over the last decade or so, as things have kind of calmed down in that battle between the situationists and the trait theorists, there's this recognition now that although personality is relatively stable and it is a meaningful concept, it predicts all sorts of important outcomes in life, it most definitely isn't fixed, and it remains to some degree malleable right the way through life.
It's also malleable according to situation, right? We might behave in a different way depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, exactly. So psychologists especially refer to so-called strong situations that really bring out different sides to our character. So an example might be, well, a really extreme example would be, for example, prison is a very extreme situation. People who go to prison, their personalities tend to be shaped very forcefully by that experience. Or athletes will talk about how they, you know, their personality literally seems to change when they walk on the pitch or walk on the court. Rafael Nadal, his mother, she's described him as being like Clark Kent off the court and Superman on the court. That's how radical the change seems to be with him. So I think one argument I make in the book is obviously you can start to be a little bit more intentional if you want about the situations you place yourself in. And then over time, you can kind of leverage those situational influences to bring out the sides to your personality that you would like to bring out.
All right, so let's talk about these big five personality traits. Extroversion has been called the rock star trait. What does that mean?
Yeah, so strong extroverts, yeah, they live fast and they take more risks. They're drawn to reward. So that it's very similar to how we talk about in everyday life. Extroverts are more sociable and so on, but it's more than that. They're more energetic, they're more active, they're more willing to take risks. And the downside to that, you could say, is they can be drawn to overindulge sometimes in drink and drugs, for example. So that's why it's kind of this rock star trait, because it's they live fast and loose, so to speak.
And how does our level of neuroticism affect who we are and how we move through the world?
If you score highly in neuroticism, it means that you're more prone to negative emotions such as shame and guilt. You tend to beat yourself up a lot. You worry a lot. So it puts you at more risk of being diagnosed with mental health problems. So I would say of all the five main personality traits, high neuroticism is the one that has the least going for it, really. It's people who score highly in this, they have more stressful lives, they have more relationship problems. So that's neuroticism. It's like the opposite of emotional resilience.
Okay. And what are the most significant differences between people with higher and lower levels of agreeableness?
So this is a really nice personality trait. This is people who score highly on this one. They tend to see the best in others. They're warm and friendly themselves, but it is more than that. They trust other people more. And you know what? They also tend to be actually be kinder to themselves. So they will seem to have an instinct for placing themselves in more positive situations. They tend to therefore, you know, get less stressed and have fewer arguments, and that they have higher empathy for other people.
I think openness to experience is a really interesting spectrum. What are the benefits of being especially motivated to do unfamiliar things and consider novel ideas?
Yeah, so if you're a high scorer in this trait, you are more willing and interested in exploring the unfamiliar. You are more aesthetically sensitive on average. You are also more likely to seek out and experience awe, you know, AWE, the emotion of awe and wonder. And there are some really significant positive outcomes for people who score highly in this trait. They are actually later in life less vulnerable to dementia. And it may well be because they live these kind of intellectually and creatively active lives. They build up a kind of so-called cognitive reserve, which can have a protective function. So if you enjoy poetry, opera, foreign language movies, that kind of thing, you're probably a high scorer in this trait.
So is openness to intelligence experience related to intelligence?
Yeah, they are correlated with one another, but they're definitely seen as distinct concepts in psychology.
Okay, and finally,
they are related. Yeah,
there is conscientiousness. What makes this one so significant for life outcomes?
Yeah, so of the big five, this one is definitely perhaps one of the, well, if not the most consequential, definitely one of them. If you score highly in conscientiousness, you tend to have more willpower. You're more orderly, self-disciplined, ambitious, industrious, and perhaps unsurprisingly, it's correlated with all sorts of positive outcomes in life, including better physical health, less stress, better relationship outcomes, more career success. And I suppose it's partly, yeah, because it has this connection with being able to resist short-term temptation and that ability to take a longer-term view and to be more self-disciplined. So that's why it has these positive outcomes.
What tools do mental health professionals have to place any one of us on the spectrum of any one of these five traits?
Do you mean how are these traits measured?
Yes.
So usually in most psychology research, it will be measured with questionnaires, pencil and paper questionnaires traditionally, or obviously these days on apps or online. And the most thorough questionnaires will have dozens and dozens of items. To have a really thorough, accurate measure of a person's personality, you don't only want to ask them to score themselves, you will also get scores from their close friends and relatives or their colleagues as well. But it's usually, these kind of personality type quizzes is the usual way. That there are some kind of quirkier ways. There's something called the lemon juice test, which I describe in my book, which is kind of connected to how much you respond to lemon juice in your mouth. The idea being that introverts are much more sensitive to stimulation, so they will salivate much more in response to lemon juice. So there are some kind of more ingenious kind of biological ways of testing personality, but it is usually measured through kind of personality quiz type.
Christian, we should talk about the way personality tends to change for everyone over the course of a lifetime. What are some traits that tend to expand or contract in predictable ways at different points in our lives?
Yeah, a change that I find reassuring is that as we get older, the evidence suggests that we gradually become less neurotic, so less prone, less prone to worry and angst, and that's something that seems to happen naturally just with age. We tend to become actually less extroverted as we grow older. Probably that's partly to do with these kind of situational influences on us. So if you imagine, as we settle down into our relationships and maybe start a family, it obviously becomes harder to live a highly sociable, extroverted life. So we tend to be shaped in that way to be less sociable. At the same time, we tend to become more agreeable, though. So we will tend to be warmer, and we tend to see the best in people more as we get older, which I think is also a reassuring finding. Conscientiousness is an interesting one that shows this kind of inverted U-shape curve. So we will tend to increase in conscientiousness up to roughly midlife. That's partly again because of how we are shaped by the roles we take on in life. So one of the strongest changes you see in personality in someone's life is when they start their first job. So they will show a spike in conscientiousness. Again, because of the demands being placed on them that shape them over time in a consistent way, when you have your first paid career role. And then so that will increase all the way up to midlife, and then it tends to start to decline in towards later life. And there's this expression for that phenomenon called la dolce vita effect. In later life, older people will tend to show declines in conscientiousness as they have this perhaps kind of as their responsibilities, not for everyone obviously, but for many people, will start to reduce as their children grow up and leave home, for example, and they retire from their professions. They will tend to have fewer demands on them, and so you might see their conscientiousness start to decline slightly. And then I think you mentioned this earlier in your intro, openness to experience also in later life, on average, tends to decline. Again, I think we can see that anecdotally. The older people will tend, they tend to like their routines. They will tend, not everyone, but on average, perhaps not to enjoy the unfamiliar so much. So those are some of the general trends that we see through life.
How much do our parents and the ways they raise us have to do with the traits we develop?
Well, actually, here the research is a little bit counterintuitive because I can speak from experience. Parents agonize over how they might be shaping their kids, and obviously they want the best for their children, and they want their children to have advantageous, all the advantages possible in life. But actually, the research suggests outside of the extremes. So I'm not talking about neglect here, things like that, which obviously is very, very damaging, but within an average household, parents' influences on their children's traits is surprisingly modest. the research suggests children's and teenagers' traits are shaped more actually outside the home by the unique experiences they have outside of the home, and especially by their peer group, so, you know, by their close friends. So that's something to bear in mind, yeah, if you're a parent, is, you know, don't beat yourself up too much. As long as you provide a consistent love and support for your kids, and you're authoritative without being authoritarian, to use the terminology in psychology, then, you know, that's the most you can do. You can't sort of shape your child to have a particular personality.
And it turns out birth order is not as influential as scientists once thought in determining personality traits, but birth spacing might be more important.
Yeah, exactly. So this is one of these kind of folk theories that, you know, just won't die. It's like an immortal belief that firstborns they're the most driven, and they're more likely to become leaders, and they're more competitive and so on. And there is some anecdotal evidence that seems to back it up. Like when you look at like US presidents, a lot of them do seem to be firstborns. So it seems to kind of back it up. But some huge studies that have involved hundreds of thousands of participants that have compared their personalities against their birth order in their family just have not supported this idea of firstborns being natural leaders. And so, yeah, that just doesn't seem to be true. Birth spacing, on the other hand, this is the idea that, yeah, if you're born close together in age with your siblings, then it's beneficial for your social development because of, I suppose, because, you know, you're more likely to play closely with a sibling who is a similar age to you. You get that you get that back and forth through your life of socializing, learning, you know, to deal with tricky social situations and difficult emotions. So again, it's not 100%, you know, sort of established finding yet, but that's what the research is suggesting, that this birth spacing is actually more relevant than birth order. So if you grew up with a sibling, one or more siblings of similar age to you, that could have been beneficial to your personality development. Conversely, if you're an only child, and that is true for me, so I'm speaking for myself here. Unfortunately, the evidence is not so good. So there's some findings suggests only children who don't get to have that practice, you know, in the home as they're growing up with dealing with social dynamics, they will tend to score lower on things like agreeability and so on. So, yeah, so it's more to do with these opportunities for practice, you could say, almost, or learning certain social skills that seems to shape our personalities in the home.
Do struggle and trauma affect personality in predictable ways?
Well, I wouldn't say in predictable ways, but trauma can have, it can have a harmful effect on personality. So it can certainly increase, you know, your risk of mental health problems and therefore increase trait neuroticism. But then for some people, trauma, you know, profoundly difficult experiences can also be a catalyst for positive change. There's a phenomenon known as post-traumatic growth. So there's this idea that actually when we go through a period of extreme stress, it can actually put us into this highly malleable state, sort of a transformative state, which then can have either positive or negative outcomes, so, which I think is difficult to predict. But for people who have a lot of social support, you know, they have plenty of warm, trusting and supportive relationships, and who are able to see a difficult, you know, trauma as, you know, they're able to see the positives in it and they can find new meaning in life from it. They can use it as a catalyst in that way. It can actually, for them, have some positive personality outcomes, but it does depend. And obviously for other people, it can lead to spirals. You know, if they're unsupported, if they're lonely, they don't have the social support, then a trauma can have a very harmful impact on them. So it's one of those ones where I think the answer is that it depends, and your own social circumstances are going to be key there as well.
And what about life partnership? Are married people different in terms of personality from those who stay single or get divorced or are widowed?
So the findings here are, Well, they tend to be as a bit of a mixed bag. So these major life experiences, yeah, like getting married, getting divorced, bereavement, they do tend to have impacts on personality. But what the research is suggesting is there's not sort of one clear pattern. And after all, that's because these experiences, it makes sense if you think about it, because subjectively they're different for everyone. So what I would say is, if you get married or if you get divorced or what have you, you can expect it to shape you in profound ways. But what's hard to say is how it will. So some studies have found, for example, that after divorce, people show increased openness and increased extroversion, almost as if they're seizing, the opportunity. Of the freedom that they now have. But other studies have not, they've struggled to replicate that finding, and that's probably because of it's just so different for everyone. I should say one quite amusing finding though for men is after divorce their conscientiousness tends to go down. And when they get married their conscientiousness tends to go up, which might reflect there's this gender difference. On average, women do tend to score higher on conscientiousness. So maybe, again, you can kind of see these socialization effects depending on who we're with, who we spend our time with, and what they expect of us and demand of us. These kind of things shape our traits as well.
All right, so we're going to spend some time now talking about how we can affect our basic personality traits deliberately. At this point, some people might be asking, why would I want to do that? Why do I need to change? What are some of the reasons people might want to do a little tweaking on any of the aspects of their big five personality traits?
Well, I guess conscientiousness is probably the most obvious because of its connections with future career success and better physical health. Something like extroversion, this is a little bit of a controversial one, the introvert extrovert spectrum, and I wouldn't want anyone who is an introvert to think that I'm saying they should change or there's anything wrong with being an introvert. All I would say is if you feel that your introversion is holding you back, an example might be if you're, let's say you're an entrepreneur, or you're starting a business, and your business could benefit from you networking and I don't know, making cold calls and that kind of thing, networking. You could benefit. You don't have to become an out and out extrovert, the life and soul of the party. But if you make some tweaks, you might find that it helps your career, for example. And there are just so many studies that suggest that when we are acting more extroverted, we tend to enjoy it. Even introverts enjoy it more than they think they will, which is probably because of just how important social contact is for our mental well-being. So again, although there's nothing wrong with being an introvert, if you personally, feel, you're more lonely, you feel lonely, you don't have as many friends as you would like, then there by upping your extroversion, you might find it easier to make friends, for example, if that's what you want to do. I mentioned the downsides of neuroticism earlier, so that's an obvious one where it's hard to argue in favor of maintaining high neuroticisms. So if there's anything you can do to reduce that trait, you'll experience less stress, less worry, less angst. So I would say that's a definite one to target. Increasing your openness, is going to help you later in life. The evidence suggests, in terms of protecting you from dementia, it's associated with being more creative, so there are obvious, career benefits. Agreeableness. This one is a little bit interesting because in some contexts, higher agreeableness has been shown to be a disadvantage. So in, cutthroat careers, higher scores in agreeableness can be taken advantage of. But overall, being more agreeable is associated with having, fewer arguments, it's better for your relationships and so on. So with most of these traits, you don't have to radically transform yourself. I think just by shifting your scores, you could enjoy some benefits, and these effects can snowball. After all, if you increase your extroversion a little, and it gives you that confidence and optimism to strike up a conversation at a business event, with someone that you wouldn't have done before, who knows what the direction it, you know, might take your business in or your career in. So I suppose I see these things as snowballing, even if you make quite modest changes.
It's good that there's room for self-improvement and that we're able to adapt to new circumstances. Is there a point, though, Christian, where healthy adaptability tips over into unhealthy instability of our personalities?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I say in the book is to be a little bit wary of, you know, you don't want to obsess over trying to make these changes, and you need to be wary of, you know, if you try and change one part of your personality, be a little bit conscious of how it could have knock-on effects for other parts of your personality. So I wouldn't want anyone to become sort of obsessed or fixated on these things. But, you know, we all do differ from situation to situation to a degree. We do vary to a certain extent, depending on the company we're in. Personality means the Latin roots of it are persona is mask, you know, because we do act in these different ways in different situations. So, you know, a degree of malleability is perfectly natural. Obviously, if you begin to feel unsettled and unnerved, take a step back, and I don't know, but take comfort as well. You know, there are these findings that, for example, people tend to feel more authentic when they're acting more in line with the person they aspire to be, with their so-called ideal selves. So perhaps we can take comfort from that, you know, that actually acting in line with the person you aspire to be is, that's arguably the real you. So, you know, you're not, I would say you're not faking it. And I find that reassuring as well.
Right. So if we're sort of not faking agreeableness, but acting more agreeable than we might naturally feel, that's not necessarily going to make us feel terrible about ourselves.
Yeah, that's what the research findings suggest. Exactly. They suggest that we feel more real when we're acting in line with the person we aspire to be.
Some people act really different under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And people are led to wonder, is the real you the drunk one or the sober one? Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I would say the real you is the sober one. I mean, the intoxicated state is temporary. So strictly speaking, you know, in personality science terms, your personality is the you when you're sober, because it's a temporary state, you know, when you're high or when you're intoxicated. Obviously, there are also the kind of a chronic effects of if you habitually drink a lot or take a lot of drugs, you do also then get obviously the chronic effects. Like it might, for example, people who smoke a lot of cannabis over a long period of time, there's evidence to suggest it can be a drain on their motivation and energy levels, which in personality trait terms, you might see reflected in lower extroversion and lower conscientiousness. So in that sense, it is having an effect on the real you, but I wouldn't say it's the real you when you're, you know, in that acute state of like a drug high or drunk or what have you.
Very quickly before I let you go, if we want to make a change in our personality, is there a way to keep track of our progress along the way?
Well, there are personality tests you can take online that allow you to do repeated testing. You could go the old fashioned way, you know, kind of keep a diary, keep a journal. You can monitor your progress just in terms of your life decisions. You know, are you becoming bolder? Are you becoming kinder? That kind of thing. So yeah, you can go the high technology route or the old fashioned way, but yeah, there are various methods.
Christian Jarrett is a cognitive neuroscientist and deputy editor of the journal Psyche. His book is called Be Who You Want, Unlocking the Science of Personality Change. Christian, thank you for making time for us today.
Oh, thanks, Chris. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.